listening to the Couples Guide podcast.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Talia.
We're both licensed marriage and family therapists, and today,
like every day,
we're debunking myths and delivering truth about dating, relationships, and everything in between.
Trust us.
It's awesome.
Episode 120.
That's so wild.
Oh, hello, mental illness.
Oh, I fancy seeing you here. I had no clue you were there.
Welcome to the party. Yeah. Who invited you?
Probably my previous childhood trauma, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I like your outfit, so.
I tried.
You always make things fun.
Oh, I'm excited for today's episode.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's actually something that our topic that we need into, we actually get a lot in our offices, and I realized that we haven't really directly talked about it on the podcast before. Because, understandably, mental illness is a thing that exists in our world and in relationships, and people who have mental illnesses also have and deserve thriving relationships. But what that can mean is people are like, well, what the hell do we do when one partner has a mental illness? Mm-hmm. What do we do in those situations? And so wanting to talk about what do you do when mental illness enters the relationship, either you start a relationship and your partner then discloses early on, the person you're dating, like, hey, just so you know, here's part of my emotional background and here's what's going on with me in my head. Or also, the context of a lot of times mental illnesses join a relationship later in life.
Yes.
Where you've been together, you've made a commitment, and then either someone discovers, oh, this is what's going on inside, or it develops and it's a new illness that's been diagnosed.
Yes. And I think this will be so applicable because we're covering both sides of the, not like using the word spectrum as this, but like both sides of the coin. Like, did you know this? And are you supporting your partner from the beginning, knowing full well that's something they come with? And or is this something that, yeah, like you said, transpires over time that we did not have any clue about? And I think the clients, couples especially that I've worked with who have the latter, have more of a shock to the system, obviously, because both partners had no clue. Whereas when you're in the beginning of a relationship and the person's forthright, or it comes out, let's say, very early on in dating, both partners do have a clue, and it makes it easier in some ways because you're both, that's part of the plan. It's like the mental, it's like if the person has a dog or a cat, it's a full package. That's what they come with. Yeah. They have certain food for the dog or cat. They have a certain routine. They have this, like, it's very similar to having like, not baggage is a negative thing, but like, this is just part of who I am. But it's more, I think for the couples I've worked with who it's a shock, it's a reckoning in the relationship because it can really oftentimes, especially if it's not treated well or right away, it can cause the partner who has the mental illness to themselves feel this way, but like to unbecome themselves. And the person who's with them is like, oh, well, I didn't sign up for this, but I also love you. And it's a very mixed feeling. So I think this will be a very helpful episode, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. I mean, it is tricky, especially when I think about the term mental illness. I do want to let listeners know, like, I'm really thinking about severe mental illness.
Yes.
So we're talking about major depressive disorder.
Right.
We're talking about generalized anxiety disorder that's so debilitating that affects every area of life. You can even throw schizophrenia in there, which admittedly can be at a whole nother level. But still, like, there's very manageable treatments and there's different ways to deal with schizophrenia in a relationship. PTSD, super common. And that's something that is commonly developed after you're in a relationship because an event will happen that will then cause a severe mental illness from PTSD. So I just want listeners to know, like, I'm really talking about it on that front.
Yeah.
Not necessarily emotional things we struggle with that don't fall into the severe mental illness category.
Yeah.
That's the scope I'm looking at for today's episode is that's what I mean by the term mental illness.
Yeah. The other one I was thinking of is OCD or even OCPD, the obsessive compulsive personality disorder. I would say out of all the personality disorders, probably the most functional, like, to be honest, because some of the symptoms are like, they're miserly with spending. They like things a certain way, but how many partners do you get? I get a ton in my office that come in, maybe not full-blown diagnosis, but like, because it's a personality disorder, obviously it's egocentric. They don't think anything's amiss with it, that they're like, no, but it should be this way. And the other partner's like, but it could be so many other ways. And that is an example of, it technically is a severe mental illness, but also the double down, because it's a personality disorder, it can get in the way and be not only therapy interfering, but also relationship interfering, because the person who has it is like, there's literally nothing wrong with me. Like, you're the one who has a problem with it. You have something wrong with you. So that was one I wanted to add on too, because I've seen that be more prevalent with the really high functioning clients I have, because they are almost perfectionistic, but sometimes that can almost be symptomatic. It almost looks like OCPD. So I wanted to bring that up too, that OCD and OCPD are for sure part of this, not just like, I have a small social phobia, but I can work through it. Like, I'm not discounting that, but that's not what you and I are talking about today.
Yeah. And we're not going to like dive into all these different mental illnesses. No. We're going to be talking about like, what are the broad pattern things you can look at? And so, yeah, this may not apply, like some of the broad pattern things we talk about may not apply to every single mental illness, but I want listeners to be kind of thinking in that kind of terms. And this is what we're addressing today.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
So I would be curious to start asking you, Talia, on in the first context, the one in which you're starting to date someone and then, you know, a couple dates and things are going really well. And then that person shares, hey, here's a part of me. Like you said, I have this cat, I have this dog. Mm-hmm. I also have this diagnosis.
Yes, I have a pet diagnosis.
Yeah. And so when you think about that context, what kind of comes to mind for you, Talia, of what do you do in that situation? Oh, and I guess I should also mention, sorry, that is my question.
Yeah.
But I should mention, right now I'm thinking about what do you do when your partner has a mental illness? There's both sides of the equation as always, but hey, when you have one, how do you talk to your partner about it? But right now I'm asking kind of about like, hey, if you're in that context, that scenario, what kind of goes through your mind about what to do when the person is trying to date, the relationship is kind of like, hey, is disclosing this? Like, what's going on in those moments?
I think the way that it's disclosed, it matters, because I've worked with couples, even in my personal life, I've heard stories from friends. They're like, yeah, I was dating and this and that. We were out drinking or something. And then they just laid on this super intense, like traumatic history or very personal information after date two. And it was like, it's not that they didn't want to share it, but I think the alcohol or whatever substance was like rising it to the top. So I think context matters and the way it's shared matters. Not saying if you go out to dinner, have like a glass of wine and something comes out, I'm not blaming it, but it really does matter in the context of like, are you sharing this because you want this person to know because you want to be closer to them? Or are you doing the, like what goes around social media now called like trauma dumping, where you're sharing all of these nitty gritty details because you really want them to abandon you or go away. And you're trying to be like, well, look how messed up I am. Like, nobody will ever love me. So it can go both ways. Like, if you're the one who's having the disclosure given to you, knowing internally, how does this feel? Does this feel authentic? Does this feel genuine? And understand that this might be the first time, or maybe one of the first few times, this person has shared it in a dating context. So waiting until they're totally done with what they're sharing, not interrupting or asking questions until you like read the cue in the conversation that they like, you know, like, oh, is there anything else you want to know? Maybe they would ask that. And then understanding that you don't have to have any questions or answers right then. You could just say, thank you so much for sharing that with me. You know, like, let's see where it goes. If there's anything you need me to do, let me know. If I can support you, like, I would just really take it like at that early on that you were a friend, that a friend was disclosing this to you. How would you handle it with a friendship? And then asking yourself, depending on what the diagnosis is, this is not a judgment. This is truly like, if the person has, let's say, clinical depression, and your mom had clinical depression when you were growing up, and you're like, I can't handle that. It's too triggering for me. I'm not going to be able to be supportive. That's not saying nothing bad about depression. You have your own personal history with it differently than having the diagnoses. And that's going to impede you being the most supportive person for that person. So you could take some time to think about if you'd be the best equipped, and then share with the person who disclosed, you know, hey, I was thinking, I dealt with this in my childhood. I unfortunately think it's going to be too triggering. you could just be friends. I think you can support a friend much differently than a romantic partner, but who you date and who you eventually marry or choose to partner with for life, regardless of the title of the partnership, it really does impact you. And if you chose to have kids, genetically, it's going to impact them too. So it's not a light decision to make. And I would say, try to think of it short term and long term. If the purpose of your dating is long term relationship or marriage, if it's just a few dates and you're just having fun, it probably wouldn't come up anyway. Those are my first thoughts on it. What about you?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's so key to remember, and you touched on this, is that is very personal sharing.
Yes.
And it often is very vulnerable, scary share when someone does say, hey, this is what's going on. Now, certainly some people are very comfortable. They're cool with their diagnosis. They get it. And it doesn't always come off as vulnerable or risky. But no matter what, in our culture, there's a huge stigma to mental illness. And so if someone's trusting you with that part of themselves, I think it's important to remember and honor that. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're talking about, going, cool, thank you for sharing mm-hmm. that. I think then, eventually, as you continue to date and you are developing a relationship with this known knowledge that this is part of your dating partner's world, a really important discussion is, okay, well, what are the relationship needs between us? And how does this mental illness, this way of being for this person, impact those needs getting expressed, getting shared, all that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. Because as a mental health professional and a humanistic therapist, I really lean away from like thinking about mental illness as disability. I just think of it as, hey, you're different.
Same.
However, I do support clients in, but imagine this was something like a differently abled human. Imagine you met someone and they disclosed a physical illness to you. Mm-hmm. I like that because that can help some people be more empathetic and accepting.
Right.
And that's the only time I love to go into sort of like the diagnostic illness part of mental illness. And so that's what I'm talking about when you're looking at needs, going like, hey, if there's a real limitation here, why don't we talk about what that's going to be ahead of time? So with depression, yeah, with depression being such a common and clear example, mm-hmm. is someone who goes like, hey, just, you know, I have this. That means sometimes I go dark. Okay, what the hell does that mean? Okay, right. That means there are just days I go into in episodes where I really can't get out of bed. And I have my team around me. You know, I'm on medication. I have right. my therapist. But here's what that can look like.
Yes.
And you then can have a conversation with that person about, okay, well, what does that mean for you? How then can we expect in a collaborative way to get everyone's needs met or understand that maybe needs aren't going to be met in those, you right. know, ways when you're not in a depressive episode.
Right.
That, and then that gives you a really nice open discussion, collaborative way when someone is available to have that versus when they're in the throes of struggling with the illness, when they're in the throes of flare up, it's way more difficult to try to navigate what those needs are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty broad. So I'm trying to get super bogged down in examples, but I think just having a nice discussion about what are our relationship needs and how will this part of one partner influence how we ask for those needs to be met and how can we meet them or when are they not going to be met? And maybe we have to look for different expectations of, oh, you're having a dark day. Okay. So this may not be a time where I know I can lean on you in a relationship. Like I would want to, when you're not having an episode.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about what that looks like for both of us.
Yeah.
And what does each person need in those moments?
And what you brought up is the person disclosing sounds, in your example, sounds like they have a treatment plan, they have awareness, they have meds on deck or supplements on deck and therapy and a self-care routine. That is a totally different level of living with an illness or living with a condition. I think we can just call it that because it's less like shaming. Living with a condition that it's like, I have it managed. So if you're dating somebody and they have it, like that's like say a level 5 management, that's going to be a much different experience for both of you, even in conversation, than if you're dating with somebody with, let's say, like a level 1, meaning not very much at all, where they're like, oh, I just finished my therapies, my first therapy ever, before mm-hmm. we had our date at happy hour, and my therapist thinks I have a super fucked up childhood and I probably have depression because of it, but oh well, and they like slam a drink back.
Yeah.
Probably not the person who's going to have insight and awareness into how to care for themselves, mainly because they've lived with the condition, but they haven't lived with the diagnosis and the freedom sometimes that can come with the treatment plan enough to have it managed. So there's unmanaged illness, and then there's managed illness or conditions. I think dating somebody who has more of a managed condition can be easier, even if it's a severe mental illness, because there's more of a system, there's more of a routine, they know their rhythms. Maybe it's when the time change happens, maybe it's, you know, like I give the joking example with CPAs, around April is probably their worst possible time to ever be asked anything because it's tax season. After April 15th, they can breathe. And then after the extensions are done, they can really breathe. Like, not that accountants have depression. That's not the parallel I'm trying to make. But there's certain seasons for people. And if you know it well, you can communicate it well. Very similar to how I work with clients who have herpes. When they get diagnosed, they come in, they feel gross and ashamed because society's done a great job of making people feel gross about having an STD or STI. And I'm like, why is this, you know, we explore it. Same thing with mental illness. Why is it so difficult to have this diagnosis? I feel like no one's going to love me. I feel like I'm broken. I feel like I'm going to be discarded. All valid feelings, again, because society has messed with us. And I say, well, let's look at this like a medical doctor. Herpes is a skin condition. It happens to flare up. It can either occur on your mouth or your genitals. The sun is usually the trigger for the mouth. The stress is the trigger for both. If you know that you can be on medications at certain times and you know your warning signs for when you're going to have an outbreak or a flare-up, you avoid contact with any type of way that you could transmit it during that time, and know that there's a smaller risk when you're in the past that and when you're shedding, and just tell the person that. You're not lying. You're being forthright. You're being controlled about it, and you're being confident in saying, like, I have a skin condition. I have a medication for it, and you have my word that whenever it flares up, we would not have contact that could put you at risk for also getting the skin condition. And they're like, oh, that makes it so much easier. And I'm like, yeah, you don't have to go like hide and cowering and be like, I'm disgusting and gross. Like, over 80% of people have it. It's actually more rare to not have herpes than it is to have it. So to be able to normalize and talk about this, same thing with mental illness with our clients, it's like how you frame it and how you disclose it matters. I want you to know I have this diagnosis. It's called depression. For me, what that means is some days I go dark. There's certain times of the year that are really hard for me. And I do want you to know I'm on medications for that. I am taking whatever, a vitamin D supplement. And I have a self-care routine that I really do have to adhere to. That includes whatever, waking up in the morning, going for a walk, and then going to the gym and meditating. I can't alter that. So that's what it would look like in our relationship. Expect that if we went on vacation or what have you. Like, you can explain it of like, same thing with a dog. I have a dog. They have to have dinner at 5 p.m. So we can either have a 3 p.m. dinner or a 7 p.m. dinner. Like, explaining it like there's nothing wrong with you is also the key in the disclosure and the receiving of the disclosure. I wanted to add that too.
Yeah, I love that. And I also think like managed versus unmanaged conditions matter early on.
For sure.
And that's where when you start dating, that's where like some cool boundaries can kind of come in, and that can actually really support someone to maybe get to from a 1 to a 5, like you said, from completely unmanaged to fully managed. I'm not suggesting then that some people should stay dating someone and it's their job to help them get to a managed condition.
But if the
context is, you're like, no, I still care about this person, I'm really interested, I think there's a space, you can have some understanding that, hey, this might be someone who has learned to live with their condition privately, and they're ready for that next step in their life to date and start to build a relationship. And they can go, oh yeah, I've been able to deal with this by myself in this way, but that doesn't really work for a relationship. And that's where relationship need discussions come up about, like, cool, well, if you want to keep doing this, it's probably important that, say, for some conditions, you get on medication. They just are important. And if you want to do that, great. So that's kind of where early dating can also support that individual by setting up some structure, some boundaries, and going, hey, this is what I would need to move forward.
Exactly. And let the if you are the person doing the disclosure, the more practice you have with it, the more understanding you'll be with yourself of knowing they're not saying no to me as a self, like I'm wrong or bad at my core. There might be something in them that they are allowed to have their own autonomy to choose not to or to be with somebody who has a certain condition. Again, same thing with pets. I'm allergic to cats. I could never be with somebody who has a cat. There's literally one, my friend has one cat who I'm not allergic to, but I still have to take a Zyrtec just in case to take the edge off if a dander gets in my eye. Yeah. That's just something I would do. And plus for me, like cat people, that's a whole personality type for the most part. Not really my thing. I don't think that that could be a thing for me if I were dating. So similar parallel, nothing against it. It's just not for me. There's going to be somebody else out there that like, you have a cat. Oh my gosh, I have five cats. Let them be together. Right. There's a level, I think, of understanding that we can reach that if the person says no, it doesn't mean you're wrong or bad or your illness is going to have you be alone forever. It means that person has hopefully done an inventory and been like, I'm not going to be the best equipped person to be your partner. You deserve someone like that. Therefore, I will step out so that person can enter your life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think being honest with ourselves about what's right for us and is this someone like we're down to do that for?
Mm-hmm.
Is this relationship worth popping a Zyrtec when you hang out? A lot of relationships, that's a yes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's a no, and that's mm-hmm. okay too.
Yeah.
And I like how you frame it where it's not about going, hey, your condition is problematic. Mm-mm. It's that's not right for me.
Right.
And early on, it's a lot easier to be able to make that assessment. And one of the things like to consider that is actually kind of where I thought about this entire episode topic about is my number one advice to anyone in a relationship where their partner has a mental illness, it's no matter when it enters the relationship. One of the things the biggest thing I want everyone to think about is if that mental illness is causing distress and dysfunction for your partner or in the relationship, it means they're already aware that there's something not good happening.
Yeah.
And I was going to say all the time, I'm sure there's a small percentage, but 99% of the time when I'm working with that in my office, the pressure that the person who's struggling with the condition puts on themselves is greater than anything else in the world.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is that they start to get really isolated in that condition where they've learned, hey, if I always talk about my depression, if I always talk about my anxiety, if I always talk about my trauma, people check out. And so they learn very quickly that it's not safe to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this big message I have for no matter when this enters a relationship is one of the best things you can do for your partner is just sit and listen to them. It's also one of the hardest things. If your partner struggles with depression and you take this advice to, cool, I will be with you and you can just tell me all of your depressive thoughts and all of this melancholy you're feeling. That's advice to sit in that person's pain with them. And one of our biggest natural human go-tos to pain is, let me get rid of it. And one of the ways we do that in a relationship is we try to problem solve. It's like, well, if you got out of bed and went for a walk, you wouldn't feel so down. That person has told themselves that thousands of times before you offer that solution.
And if it would have worked, not it would have worked by now.
Yeah, if it worked, it would have happened. That's why this is a mental illness.
Yeah.
And so the suggestion, this advice I'm giving is one of the biggest things you can do to support your partner is sit and allow them to share with you, here are all of my anxious thoughts. Here's everything going on. Can you accept me for who I am and still love me despite that I even struggle to love myself at times?
And not try to fix me.
Not try to fix me, but just accept it. So that's my tip and my suggestion, a big thing to take from it. And that relates to the part we said right before that of when it's early on, are you choosing like, hey, is this something that you're signing up for? I think it's really important to check your bandwidth and go, hey, can I do that? Is this something I'm willing to do?
Yeah.
Or if this is a long-term relationship, is what do I need to do to be able to do that in order to support this person that I love?
Yeah.
It's a big question, like, but yeah. If you get that template in mind, it can give you an idea like, oh, this is the number one thing I can do to help be in relationship with someone who's struggling with one of these types of diagnoses.
Yeah. And that's also where knowing your own, knowing your own limits and your own history with the diagnosis, again, not necessarily having it yourself, but being around somebody who had it, the repetition compulsion psychoanalytically is strong in a lot of people to be like inadvertently imago workup, but like inadvertently picking somebody who reminds you of one or both parents who had a similar mental illness or family member or what have you. And you want to like basically recapitulate the past because you want a chance to heal what you couldn't have healed back then or save your parent in a way you couldn't have saved them. Like all of this is subconscious. That be very mindful if you find yourself consistently only, I'm putting that in quotes, dating partners who have severe mental illness. Does anybody in your family history have that? Like, where is this coming from? Because that's not on the standard level. That's not usually someone's type. I'm not saying it's a negative, but if you look at yourself and you're like, every single person I've dated has had some sort of severe mental illness, that's definitely something for you to take a look at, because there's a pleaser, helper, fixer, savior, white knight syndrome, something that you have clearly going on, because that's usually, again, not the lineup. And there's something about it that you keep going back to because it feels like unfinished business. So if it's like a one-off thing, and this is probably a good segue into if you're dating somebody and you didn't know in the beginning, but the last note I wanted to add for the, if you did know that in the beginning and you chose to stay, but then you're like, oh my God, this is exhausting. It's like, well, you brought it on yourself. Like, what did you expect? Like, and that's a genuine question to ask yourself. What am I expecting this relationship to be and not be? And do I think that's even reasonable given both of our limitations, right? Mm-hmm. I'm living with somebody who has a condition they're living with. It's managed. But what if, like we talked about, the pandemic hits and they slide back down to a level one, or they can't get access to their meds because there's a shortage, or the time change happens and they can't do their normal self-care routine and they didn't have one in place and it's only been a year that they've been level five managed. Like, I think there's a lot more thorough questions to be asked in the beginning, but also really make sure, like, is this the person you're really wanting to date, or is this some childhood thing that you're trying to heal with this person and finally, you know, to master whatever you didn't get to in childhood? So that's just me more analytically, something I would suggest for people to take a look at. Like, there's nothing wrong if you choose to date somebody. There's nothing wrong if you don't choose to date somebody like this. But if this is your type and you're like, I like the broken ones because I can fix them and I know all the solutions, please go to therapy.
Yeah. Especially in relationship. It's really not about, I think there's always a red flag if you're trying to fix someone.
Yeah.
Because I think a really big red flag is if you see someone as broken.
Correct.
And this is all about what my whole thing is about how can you accept and love the person for who they fully are with this condition.
Correct.
You know, someone who's blind is not broken.
No, absolutely not. No.
They have a different set of perceptions and world views, ways of perceiving the world, is what I'm trying to say. And there's nothing broken about that.
No, definitely
and
not.
So we love those people. We love everyone for exactly who they are. And that's part of what this is about leaning into. And it's a unique stressor. I think you said earlier, shock, when you have loved someone for a few decades and then something changes.
Surprise,
and then
surprise.
This condition. Yeah. Yeah. Then it enters. Then someone loses their sight. Then someone develops depression, anxiety, has a traumatic event and causes severe PTSD. It is very difficult because some of those needs and norms and expectations that both partners were aligned for have now changed.
They have.
And
to.
Especially when we're talking about mental illness, you have zero choice over that. No one goes, yes, let me choose to get ill.
Right.
Let me choose this.
And in my 25th year, I will choose severe depression.
It's just, it's inherently like there's no one at fault.
Correct. Correct. I would say there's, I think with substance use disorder, that would be an exception, not to say like fault blame, but like if the person, because that's usually a progressive disease, if the person had that and there were like, there's usually inklings from the beginning of the relationship and it kept getting worse and that's not managed, then that would definitely be the person's, like the onus would be on them. But when it comes from the genetic factors of it, like if it's schizophrenia or if it's a lot of women get depression and anxiety only after kids because of all the hormonal changes, mm-hmm. and then the societal expectations on top of it, it's hard to get back to your normal self because that doesn't, it's mm-hmm. never going to exist anymore. That there's a higher likelihood, the longer you're with somebody, the more life events you have, the more opportunity for growth, but also trauma to exist, the more likely a diagnosis could come up, to your point, because you're living with someone, especially with PTSD, the person might not know that they have it as bad as they do, not saying it's negative bad, like as intensely as they do, until they finally feel the safety of a relationship. And that's when the guard comes down, but all the triggers start coming out too, because the nervous system has finally regulated enough to be like, oh, we can breathe, like we're safe. Mm-hmm. But then the back of the mind is like, but remember all the times we weren't safe? We should bring that up now because we feel safe enough too. So that is one like nuanced diagnosis, of course, because it could have existed prior to the relationship. The person could be so high functioning, they're coping the best they can through it. Then they finally slow down and enjoy their life and they're like, oh, I didn't realize how much I hadn't worked on this PTSD, or I didn't realize how much it had affected my view of attachment or what have you. So that's, I definitely think, one to bring up as we transition to the second part of the conversation. If you don't know your partner has a mental illness, or it was previously, let's say, well managed, and then it like went into remission almost and came back up because a huge life stressor happens, how do you deal with it then? How do you deal with it when you're basically meeting a new version of your partner, a new person?
Yeah. I mean, I think the number one thing is that I think about it is fairly obvious, like get a lot of education.
Yes.
Learn together.
Yes.
Go like, whoa, here's this new thing. Hopefully that's happening because you probably discovered this somehow. Then you've reached out to a professional.
Yeah.
Whether it's a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a therapist, someone to be like, hey, what's going on? Which by the way, this is actually a good moment that probably should have done at the top of the episode, but if highly recommend the organization NAMI, NMI.
Yes.
You can do NAMI.org, yeah. And there's a lot of local chapters for this organization. I forget what that stands for. It's the
National Alliance.
National Alliance. Yeah. Yeah. And they're a great resource to educate yourself, as well as in a lot of cities, bigger cities, they have great groups and places you can actually go
meetings,
to have community.
Yes.
Both for mm-hmm. people who have mental illness and for people in relationships with people with mental illness. So just a heads up, really great thing that I highly recommend, NAMI.org.
Yes.
That being said, so that, I think that's kind of like somewhat of a common sense, but don't overlook like, hey, learn about this. When it's real, like just like any kind of big new diagnosis, get some education and figure out, hey, what is this going to look like?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Next, I go back to the whole needs thing, just like mm-hmm. first time. Yes, then back to remember, like a lot of times this is more about sitting and accepting someone than trying to problem solve.
Correct.
And change
or fix
something about them. But the biggest thing that I think about for when this enters a relationship later in a relationship is everyone, please grieve. Just grieve.
Mm-hmm.
Just acknowledge that something big has changed.
Shift. There's a shift.
And there's a huge shift. And that means there's certain things that you were planning, expecting, and loving about your potential future that is going to be different now.
Correct.
Doesn't necessarily mean that it's worse.
No. Different is the best way to put it.
Whatever it was different. And there's a loss to some, there's an emotional loss we have when what we're expecting, what we had changes. So have a discussion within your relationship about what are we grieving here? Oh, you know what? Now our Saturdays are going to look different because now we need to attune to this thing to make sure that we're attuning to the illness, this condition, so we can stay healthy still.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. I really liked getting coffee every Saturday morning on the dog walk.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. I'm using a silly example, but like grieve that like, oh, that's not going to happen anymore. Grieve that there might be times where you can feel more distant from your partner because you're going to have to relearn how to connect deeply with some of these changes.
And that's what I explain to couples who have this shift, especially after a long period of time together, that whether or not I go existential, whether or not you stay with this person or not is your choice. I can't decide that for you. I will say, though, you will have to relearn and get to know somebody either way. Whether you leave this person and you start with a new person, or you can choose to channel that into the person you're currently with. Whether you like are like, okay, I'm all in, like no discernment counseling needed. I'll do anything. Let's keep it going. Or like, let's see if this is livable for 6 months to a year. Because again, I didn't make this agreement in the beginning. Both of us are having to update. Let's try and give it our all. And if at that point, the good old college try, if at that point it feel like it's not a good fit, then you could choose to leave. You could also choose to stay. That is not what we're here to decide. What we're here to help with is supporting the emotions behind it and really making sure, putting that in quotes too, that the partners get the proper care and understand the gravity of, okay, if you stay, let's plan for both of you. What's the ideal? What's the more realistic? If you leave, what's the ideal? What's the more realistic? Let's come to some sort of agreement and path, because our job again is to guide those emotions and to help them come up with not picking the decision, but what would each decision look like, feel like, be like. Let's try it on, let's explore it before you're actually making any of those and not making decisions too rashly. Because like you said, hopefully the person who has the condition is so aware of what is going on for them, or they're seeking help or they're seeking treatment, that is already a good sign. Whereas if something develops and they're like dismissing it, oh, it'll go away, oh, I'm not going to look at it, which is honestly, unfortunately, very common as people get older. The trope is that like men never go to the doctor, but they live longer because women nag them. If they're like, oh, you should really go get that mole checked out. You should really go get that mole checked out. And they go get it checked out, and God forbid is like cancer or something terrible. And the guy's like, oh, without you, I would have died. Like, yes, that's why I said to go get it checked out 6 months ago. The same thing with a mental or physical illness. When it comes to this, like if your partner is sharing with you, I'm noticing you're changing, something's going on, you seem different. I've never seen you like this before, and not in like a compliment way of like, oh, that's a new dress, I've never seen you like that before. Listen to your partner, especially if you've known them for such a long time. They're one of the best historians for who you are and who you weren't, right? And who you might be becoming. And that person cares about you. They wouldn't have chosen to be with you for so long or at any point of time if they didn't. It might be worthwhile going to get some of those things checked out of like, yeah, I know you've been on edge lately. You've been irritable, whatever. Let's say couples get in a car accident, God forbid. That can be a very traumatizing and triggering event. And somebody could have poorly managed mental health conditions after that can come up. That's worthwhile to go get checked out. So whether there's a precipitating incident or event, or it just kind of comes about over time, when you didn't know that about your partner, it does feel like you're living with a stranger. You will feel like, I've gone this before. You will feel like you don't recognize them. You will feel like that's not who you signed up for. This is not what you signed up for. You feel wronged. You feel it's unfair. You feel frustrated. Like when you're the partner who's receiving that change, it is very difficult. And also when you're the partner going through that change, it's not without pain. And it's not without sadness of like, I miss me too. Like when I went through really bad postpartum depression and anxiety, I didn't recognize myself. It didn't affect my relationship with my kid, thank God, but it affected my relationships with everybody else. And that to me was like, I don't even know me anymore. And how jarring that was, that I'm, you know, other people are like, you're not recognizable. And I'm like, I'm not recognizable to me either. Like, that's not helpful information. So like, knowing that the person going through the change also has the struggle, as well as the recipient of the person going through the change.
Yeah. Well, and that's where like my idea of like grief, like really leans in, hopefully allowing couples to have also compassion together. Like, hey, this is a huge loss, or I'm feeling destabilized here.
Yeah.
No matter which side of the relationship you're on, there's just the weight and the power of big changes.
Yes.
And too often in our culture, people try to go to, okay, how do we address the change and figure it out and come solve up with some priorities and solve it before taking a step of going, well, before we even come to any of that, let's just grieve this together. Because the big deal is if you can do that and emotionally process and get to a better grounded place, which allows you to accept and be a team, you will come with infinitely better priorities and solutions and figure it out as a team much better. Also, once you've appropriately grieved, that's part of the healing process of pain. That when there are pain moments for change, that can kind of get in the way of couples working together. But when you've done some grieving, you've done some healing about, hey, this is hard and this sucks, then you can come from a place of, all right, I'm not acting out of pain now. I'm not acting out of fear and sadness now. I'm acting out of compassion and love. And then what does that mean for our relationship? And that's where you can go back to those collaborative discussions of needs. I also think a reevaluation of boundaries.
Yes, definitely.
You know, couples, especially we're talking, you know, I was thinking about the 20-year couple, because I was thinking about that like halfway through a long-term relationship. When you're thinking like, hey, we've been together 20 years, there's norms that have been established. There's been boundaries. I even think an example like the whole, hey, get your mold checked boundary, that can work for a little bit of like, you know, we're kind of taking, in that example, you know, the joke is the woman's taking responsibility for the man's health. Well, sometimes that really has got to be turned upside down, especially when you're talking about mental health shifts. It's really about that person take their own responsibility.
100, great, great.
And you have to be careful that you don't fall into the trap of weight. Now one person's trying to take responsibility for the other person's health. Yeah. That's not going to work. It's going to build resentment.
Correct. I think physical health, like if you're showering together, let's say that's your routine, that's part of your routine, and you notice like that wasn't there last week or yesterday, then naturally,
that looks dark.
Like, yes, tell your partner. Mental illness is different in the sense that it does need to be, the onus needs to be on the individual who has the mental illness to know to get treatment, or if they can't access it, and let's say their partner works at a place that has access to it, they could ask of like, hey, this is my struggle and I own it. Could you help me with resources? Like, it doesn't mean you can't help your partner, but the responsibility of the healing must be on the person who has the diagnosis or the condition to heal. Again, it doesn't mean that you can't ask for help or that you can't lean on your partner, but you can't expect them to make your doctor's appointments or this, unless that's the agreement that like their doctor's like, they're so catatonic, they won't remember. Totally different. But we're talking about like severe, but still moderately functioning, that would also be something that you would ask for. That's totally different than the partner going in and doing it on your behalf, then getting resentful because they're caretaking for you in a way that you didn't ask for. So let's to really drive the point home, that if the partner's like, hey, I want to get myself help, I know though in my struggle with whatever it is, severe ADHD, because there was a shortage on the stimulant medications for a while, and some people couldn't get their hands on it, like even with the prescription, that they had to rely on coping skills, and not every coping skill worked because sometimes ADHD does need to be medicated, that I worked with couples that they had to remind their partner more than usual. They weren't taking responsibility or caretaking, but their partner was like, in my right mind, I need your help with this condition. And the partner was able to help. Similar to if you had a dog, hey, I got to go away for a business trip. Could you walk Fluffy for the next 3 days? Even though that's my thing that I usually do, I need your help with that. Like if there's the time limit. So I would say, yes, you have to ask for your partner to do that. Otherwise it is going to build resentment because they're not your parent. You're responsible for your body.
Yeah. And I mean, my bigger, I agree with all that. And I think I'm coming from a very like the bird's eye view of have the conversation about boundaries. Like, and how is that changing? What does that look like? Like a good example from that is, let's say someone, because of this condition that's been emerging, is going to have a dark day. And in the past, the relationship was, hey, if someone was feeling really down, maybe that's where the other person relationship would go into kind of nurse mode. Let me help you out. Let me take care of you. Oh, okay. I won't go out and do, you know, socialize with our plans. I'll just, you know, stay home and be with you while you're having a bad day. Well, maybe the boundaries now for, hey, this is going to be a condition and this is going to happen more regularly. Maybe it's going to be different where if you have a dark day now, it's like, oh, that sucks. You're safe.
Yes.
So stay in bed safe. If safety is established, I'm going to go out and hang out with my friends now.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to take the kids out and do this. Whereas before, maybe that's not how the pattern of your relationship would have worked.
Right.
Now that might be a new expectation. And those aren't recommendations of how to do stuff, by the way, listeners. I'm just giving an example of having a bigger discussion of what could look different and what the new boundaries are.
Yeah.
given the new context. It's that like now there's going to be different mental health stuff going on.
With substance use, in the beginning, it's most recommended, especially if it's not like a situational substance use or like hard drugs, obviously. But if it's, if there's concern around, let's say, alcohol, and the partner's like, I'm working on it. I'm not saying you have to change your life. If it doesn't make a difference to you, if the first month or two that I'm going through this, if you could at least just not drink in front of me, like if you go out with your friends, if you this, if like, I, it's not that I'm saying don't drink, but I'm working on my stuff and I think it would be too triggering. Would you mind? Or I need you to not drink in front of me. And then eventually couples reach a new homeostasis or baseline. And usually they're able to go out together again. One could order a drink at dinner, one can't. Not every couple can get there. I'm not, like you said, I'm not saying the blanket advice, but I would say there are certain boundaries and parameters. Also, the more roles and responsibilities you have, if you have kids and a dog and this, and you have a dark day and you're having depression or severe anxiety, you need to outsource the responsibilities that you usually hold onto someone, a partner, a dog walker, a nanny, a baby, like a family friend. Like it can't just be, I'm having this and I can't function at all. And I'm going to also shirk my responsibilities. And if your depression does get so bad that that happens, that is a time to look at different levels of care, different medications, what have you, to manage it better. Or if you're the type of person who knows that, all the more reason to share that in the beginning before somebody commits to you, because on both sides, it's unfair that you didn't get what you wanted in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all of this, well, actually, no, never mind. I was going to do a summary, but a new idea is I also want to mention that like this emotional process and this boundary process can really be important to when you also talk about needs and getting needs met, like I was saying earlier with the other context. Because now, with this change from one partner going on inside of them, there might be ways that relational needs of feeling valued, respected, loved, and safe were being met that will no longer make sense.
100%.
And so we need to go, okay, within this new context, how do we get those needs met? And making sure that it's realistic expectations while accepting the changes inside of your partner. So kind of back to the dark day example of going out with the kids, like if you're noticing that now being, you know, your partner staying in bed has you feeling like you don't matter, you're not appreciated, you're not valued, then there can be a discussion like, well, how do we get this met in different ways that is appropriate, that is achievable for someone who's struggling with that condition, instead of the old expectations of, well, I expect you to get up in the morning and get the kids ready, and now that's not happening. Okay, how's a different way for that to go down? How can that look? And how can there be a change of those needs being met?
Yeah.
When someone is struggling with this type of condition. So that's kind of repeat what I already said, but I wanted to add that tack on before we wrapped up. It's another way to use those discussions to address what really matters for a relationship to stay strong, for a relationship to continue to grow and thrive, even when a mental illness enters the relationship.
Yeah, definitely. And the modifications might be temporary. Like, let's say the person has more seasonal affective disorder, but it's severe, or they have major depressive episodes once a year, like clockwork between Christmas and New Year's, then the expectations are remanaged for surrounding that time, like sandwiching it before, during, and after. That is, I think, unique and different from a partner where, and this is up to the individual listening to this, where the partner has an illness, that the modifications are going to be like for life. Like the relationship will not ever look like it did before. And that's the existential choice that you have to make. Do you still want to be in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Love that. Let's call that a show. That's a lot already. And lots of different ideas about, I think, at least from my perspective, of how do you sit, accept, and acknowledge this is happening without it trying to be a, let's completely change the person. If anything, that's my through line of like, hey, let's look at this and be honest and go, hey, this is what's hard. But let's have upfront discussions so we can set ourselves up for success. That's right. I kind of end with this one. Any last thoughts, Talia?
I would say give yourself grace. Give yourself more grace than you give your partner at first, because it's easier, and then you can eventually extend it to them. And get your own support. If you are the person who is the recipient of the change, please go get your own therapist, have your own self-care, your own support team, have somebody else who can help you manage what you need to manage with this new information. And it's not betraying your partner. You're not being rude to them or disrespectful to the relationship. In fact, it's more respectful to the relationship if you have your reactions contained professionally, if you will. It doesn't mean you don't share them with your partner, but it does really help to have a therapist to walk you through that, you know, the emotional validation, what have you, and you can be more blunt with them, what you really wish you could say to your partner. Then they help you organize, like, it sounds like what you really want to say or convey is this. What if you tried saying that? Yes, all the anger and stuff is for me and my therapist to work through. The core of, and the reason why I'm so angry is because I realize this need is going to go unmet. That's going to be what you want to share with your partner. So get your own support if you are the one receiving this. And if you're the one who has come up with or has a condition come up, then also please go get support.
Yeah, I think that's also a great through line to always remember in relationship, finding the supports you need, whether it's professional or just, you know, relational with other friends and family. That allows you to show up for the best way you can in your relationship to keep that thing so strong and sacred. Let's wrap it there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you got questions for us or you want us to answer a relationship topic on the podcast, shoot us an email, ryanandtalia@thecouplesguidepodcast.com.
And you can also DM me when I do my, they're kind of getting back to weekly Q&As. And if there's a question that's long enough, we'll turn it into an episode.
Thanks so much, everyone. Take good care.